to Corporate America by William Granville Jr. Mr. Granville is an executive with Mobile Corporation. He is the author of Just Say Yes, published by Career Communications Group. In 1957, I was head of an inner-city gang in New Jersey called the Whips East Trenton Trotters that had a snake as its symbol. Once, I led my gang in a brawl with a rival gang, which led to the closing of Trenton High School for a day, a school with 2,500 students. I almost ended up in jail for a long stay, but Mrs. Bessie Hill saved my neck. In her work as a teacher and guidance counselor at Trenton High, she probably had many calls to rescue unruly boys who got themselves into as much trouble as I did. Some of the times she must have said no. But she saw something in me, something even I didn't know was there, and she stuck her neck out to save mine. Mrs. Hill, who had taken her own time to accompany me to court and stand up for me, helped to stem the alienation my mother and I felt. Mrs. Hill saved my neck in court that day, and afterward, educationally. And I needed a lot of saving. She had seen something in me, despite the dismal grades I had earned in my industrial arts courses. She spoke up firmly when the judge called on her, telling him I was a good boy who had fallen in with the wrong crowd. I had something to offer society. Something better than it had seen from the leader of the Whips, if I could straighten out. She asked the judge to give me one more chance, and he must have sensed something, too, because he gave it to me. Thank God for Mrs. Hill. She challenged me, and as an 11th grader, I decided to give academic studies a try. I was scared to death. All my test grades read either D or F, and here I was enrolled in college preparatory classes because someone believed in me. As it turned out, Mrs. Hill had been right. I had been wrongly placed in the industrial arts curriculum, and I took to the new course load like a duck to water. She was behind me all the way, and what she told my teachers caused many of them to take a fresh interest in me. That motivated me. When Mrs. Hill and others showed interest, I felt I was worth something. It was an amazing experience. I hadn't known such feelings before. In recent years, I felt it was my turn to give something back to Mrs. Hill and all those others who invested their time and energy in rescuing a confused young man who didn't know what to do with himself. I want to create some good feelings of my own for young people who might not have a chance to succeed otherwise. I want to take motivated minority high school students and get them grounded in the business world so they can begin their climb and later reach back to help others. That is the primary mission of the Granville Academy, named to honor my parents, a nonprofit organization designed for students ages 13 to 18. At the Academy, they can gain introductory knowledge of business and industry, including an understanding of the language, basic principles, and environment in which industry operates. The process and content I used in starting up the Academy have remained essentially the same. The Granville Academy, an intensive after-school program, enrolls all beginning students in an entry group. The entry group is designed to complement the student's normal school schedule. One of the goals is to emphasize the importance of skills in accounting, writing, and speaking for success in corporate America. Students are chosen based on their high motivation and interest, as well as academic achievement. In the beginning, we looked for youngsters who had top grades. Later, however, we included those who displayed high motivation, even if their grades were low. At Academy sessions, we introduced teenagers to a whole new language, principles of savings and investments, finance and accounting, effective business writing and oral communication skills, interpersonal skills, domestic and international commerce, stocks, commodities, and other markets, compensation and other perks in corporate America, science, engineering, and technology's role in business, annual reports, financial statements, and business media, leadership skills. The Granville Academy's theme is Grooming Tomorrow's Capitalist, Our Investment in the Future. We want students to be successful, but we also want them to contribute something to their home community once they have succeeded. For most blacks in the inner city, capitalists were people who owned everything, surrendered nothing without a knockdown, drag-out fight, and were quick to deny credit or repossess cars, furnishings, or houses during bad times. And here I was, going around with the message, hey, take advantage of the capitalist system. Not only that, I wanted to groom their children to be tomorrow's capitalists. It seems curious, in the heartland of capitalism, that systems of economic organization that everyone else is eager to learn would be hard to sell. But they were. People didn't want to hear what I had to say, but I kept it up. Sometimes I used different tactics. I would say to parents that I saw their sons and daughters someday as chairman of the board at General Motors, chief financial officer at IBM, president of Xerox, head of Mobile. Most people understand the language of ambition, even if they rarely admit it in public, and blue-collar workers are no different. Everyone wants his or her children to go as high as possible, and so people began to open up to that message. To deal with some of the initial misunderstanding about what I was trying to do, I got as many people involved in the project as I could. We sent announcements to churches, schools, fraternities, sororities, and community groups. I made sure the presidents and chief executive officers of traditional community groups were involved. I communicated with uplift organizations, such as the Urban League and NAACP, and with many cultural and religious groups. The secret to getting this project off the ground was credibility, a factor which can't be emphasized enough. I needed to prove to people this wasn't just some wild idea I cooked up. It takes success to win over skeptics. We started small and the word began to spread. Hey, they're teaching good stuff to these kids at the academy. It's new. It's not like the things we've been told before. The academy students went back to school with new motivation, and their teachers started to see them express themselves better. They, too, became believers. Families paid more and more attention to their youngsters' schoolwork, and when the students started to talk about credit cards, mortgages, insurance, and automobile purchases, their parents listened. Parent involvement is the key to any new thrust in education. But we found that many parents weren't communicating with their children. That meant bringing in the families to get them more involved in the activities. And not every person who is a good role model knows how to talk to young people. Role models who spoke on important topics but failed to get across to the students were reassigned to other more productive activities. After graduation, participants receive immediate membership in the Granville Academy Advanced Group. They get information on how to qualify for programs such as InRoads Corporate Interns Program. Graduates also get subscriptions to the Wall Street Journal, Fortune, Business Week, U.S. Black Engineer, and Black Enterprise magazines, as well as 2 shares of stock in a major corporation. By 1988, the Granville Academy had garnered enough support to expand. It still starts at the 8th grade level, but now instead of stopping at grade 10, it goes right up through grade 12. Ryder College, several miles from my home in Lawrenceville, outside Trenton, New Jersey, agreed to help sponsor the Advanced Group program, which has 2 subgroups in Science, Engineering, and Technology, SET, and Finance, Accounting, and Economic Disciplines, FED. A total of 130 students attended the 3 sections of this year's program. The academy is readily adaptable to being established in other cities. Plans for the future include starting academies in a number of other major cities, such as Cleveland, Camden, Los Angeles, and New Orleans. One of the Granville Academy's most significant features is the price. Tuition is free. When you're working with inner-city youths, financial obstacles can be significant barriers to participation. That's not to say the academy runs by magic. It still needs money, roughly $45,000 a year, to operate each program. When it first started, there was only one program, and the expenses came mostly out of my pocket as needed. Now, its list of supporters has grown. I contribute only what isn't raised from the community and from corporate supporters. My employer, Mobil, is very high on employee volunteerism for worthwhile causes. Mobil has supported the Academy and my efforts financially and in other ways. The Academy also has received financial or other assistance from Career Communications, publisher of U.S. Black Engineer and Hispanic Engineer magazines, Ryder College, the National Action Council for Minorities in Engineering, the Princeton Theological Seminary, and Inroads Incorporated, to name but a few organizations. I have always had the goal, however, to get the Academy on a financial base of which 65% comes from community support and only 35% from outside. Blacks won't achieve economic integration unless most of the financing comes from within our community. The money is there, but so far it hasn't been used in ways that enhance the community's ability to provide for its own future. The Granville Academy concept is a method of helping young people as I was helped. It works because we have kept the concepts simple and basic, and because we request only minimal time from people who volunteer their service as staff and role models. It is in tune with the needs of corporate America to help meet this nation's human capital and educational crises. It fosters a team spirit among students, parents, and staffers who have a clear understanding of the mission, objectives, and goals of the Academy. Finally, the Academy succeeds because it's relatively inexpensive with its all-volunteer staff. If academies were in place wherever young minority students live and go to school, they would go a long way toward resolving this nation's need for fresh, talented, highly motivated human capital in science, engineering, and high technology. End of From Gangland to Corporate America by William Granville, Jr. A Fee Classic. I, Pencil by Leonard E. Reed. To summarize the philosophy of freedom and marvel at the results, one must wonder at the mystery of the creation of so simple an item as a lead pencil. Here is a pencil story, as told to Fee's founder, Leonard Reed, in 1958. The pencil's official name is Mongol 482. Its many ingredients were assembled, fabricated, and finished in Eberhard Faber Pencil Company, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Over the years, some of the names and places described here have changed, but the basic process and the principle are the same. I am a lead pencil. The ordinary wooden pencil, familiar to all boys and girls and adults who can read and write. Writing is both my vocation and my avocation. That's all I do. You may wonder why I should write a genealogy. Well, to begin with, my story is interesting. And next, I am a mystery. More so than a tree or a sunset or even a flash of lightning. But sadly, I am taken for granted by those who use me, as if I were a mere incident and without background. This supercilious attitude relegates me to the level of the commonplace. This is a species of the grievous error in which mankind cannot too long persist without peril. For, the wise G.K. Chesterton observed, we are perishing for want of wonder, not for want of wonders. I, pencil, simple though I appear to be, merit your wonder and awe, a claim I shall attempt to prove. In fact, if you can understand me, no, that's too much to ask of anyone, if you can become aware of the miraculousness which I symbolize, you can help save the freedom mankind is so unhappily losing. I have a profound lesson to teach, and I can teach this lesson better than can an automobile, or an airplane, or a mechanical dishwasher, because I am seemingly so simple. Simple, yes. Not a single person on the face of this earth knows how to make me. This sounds fantastic, doesn't it? Especially when it is realized that there are about 1.5 billion of my kind produced in the USA each year. Pick me up and look me over. What do you see? Not much meets the eye. There's some wood, lacquer, the printed labeling, graphite lead, a bit of metal, and an eraser. Just as you cannot trace your family tree back very far, so it is impossible for me to name and explain all my antecedents. But I would like to suggest enough of them to impress upon you the richness and complexity of my background. My family tree begins with what in fact is a tree, a cedar of straight grain that grows in Northern California and Oregon. Now, contemplate all the saws and trucks and rope and the countless other gear used in harvesting and carting the cedar logs to the railroad siding. Think of all the persons and the numberless skills that went into their fabrication, the mining of ore, the making of steel, and its refinement into saws, axes, motors, the growing of hemp and bringing it through all the stages to heavy and strong rope, the logging camps with their beds and mess halls, the cookery and the raising of all the foods. Why, untold thousands of persons had a hand in every cup of coffee the loggers drink. The logs are shipped to a mill in San Leandro, California. Can you imagine the individuals who make flat cars and rails and railroad engines and who construct and install the communication systems incidental thereto? These legions are among my antecedents. Consider the millwork in San Leandro. The cedar logs are cut into small, pencil-length slats, less than 1/4 of an inch in thickness. These are kiln-dried and then tinted for the same reason women put rouge on their faces. People prefer that I look pretty, not a pallid white. The slats are waxed and kiln-dried again. How many skills went into the making of the tint and the kilns, into supplying the heat, the light, and power, the belts, motors, and all the other things a mill requires? Sweepers in the mill among my ancestors, yes, and included are the men who poured the concrete for the dam of a Pacific Gas and Electric Company hydroplant which supplies the mill's power. Don't overlook the ancestors present and distant who have a hand in transporting 60 carloads of slats across the nation from California to Wilkes-Barre. Once in the pencil factory, millions of dollars in machinery and building, all capital accumulated by thrifty and saving parents of mine, each slat is given 8 grooves by a complex machine, after which another machine lays lead in every other slat, applies glue, and places another slat atop, a lead sandwich, so to speak. 7 brothers and I are mechanically carved from this wood-clinched sandwich. My lead itself, it contains no lead at all, is complex. The graphite is mined in Sri Lanka. Consider these miners and those who make their many tools, and the makers of the paper sacks in which the graphite is shipped, and those who make the string that ties the sacks, and those who put them aboard ships, and those who make the ships. Even the lighthouse keepers along the way assisted in my birth, and the harbor pilots. The graphite is mixed with clay from Mississippi, in which ammonium hydroxide is used in the refining process. Then wetting agents are added, such as sulfonated tallow, animal fats chemically reacted with sulfuric acid. After passing through numerous machines, the mixture finally appears as endless extrusions, as from a sausage grinder, cut to size, dried and baked for several hours at 1,850 degrees Fahrenheit. To increase their strength and smoothness, the leads are then treated with a hot mixture which includes candelilla wax from Mexico, paraffin wax, and hydrogenated natural fats. My cedar receives 6 coats of lacquer. Do you know all of the ingredients of lacquer? Who would think that the growers of castor beans and the refiners of castor oil are a part of it? They are. Why, even the processes by which the lacquer is made a beautiful yellow involve the skills of more persons than one can enumerate. Observe the labeling. That's a film formed by applying heat to carbon black mixed with resins. How do you make resins, and what, pray, is carbon black? My bit of metal, the ferrule, is brass. Think of all the persons who mine zinc and copper, and those who have the skills to make shiny sheet brass from these products of nature. Those black rings on my ferrule are black nickel. What is black nickel, and how is it applied? The complete story of why the center of my ferrule has no black nickel on it would take pages to explain. Then, there's my crowning glory, inelegantly referred to in the trade as the plug, the part man uses to erase the errors he makes with me. An ingredient called factice is what does the erasing. It is a rubber-like product made by reacting rapeseed oil from the Dutch East Indies with sulfur chloride. Rubber, contrary to the common notion, is only for binding purposes. Then, too, there are numerous vulcanizing and accelerating agents. The pumice comes from Italy, and the pigment which gives the plug its color is cadmium sulfide. Does anyone wish to challenge my earlier assertion that no single person on the face of this earth knows how to make me? Actually, millions of human beings have had a hand in my creation, no one of whom even knows more than a very few of the others. Now, you may say that I go too far in relating the picker of a coffee berry in far-off Brazil and food growers elsewhere to my creation, that this is an extreme position. I shall stand by my claim. There isn't a single person in all these millions, including the president of the pencil company, who contributes more than a tiny, infinitesimal bit of know-how. From the standpoint of know-how, the only difference between the miner of graphite in Sri Lanka and the logger in Oregon is in the type of know-how. Neither the miner nor the logger can be dispensed with any more than can the chemist at the factory or the worker in the oil field, paraffin being a byproduct of petroleum. Here is an astounding fact. Neither the worker in the oil field, nor the chemist, nor the digger of graphite or clay, nor any who mans or makes the ships or trains or trucks, nor the one who runs the machine that does the knurling on my bit of metal, nor the president of the company, performs his singular task because he wants me. Each one wants me less, perhaps, than does a child in the first grade. Indeed, there are some among this vast multitude who never saw a pencil, nor would they know how to use one. Their motivation is other than me. Perhaps it is something like this. Each of these millions sees that he can thus exchange his tiny know-how for the goods and services he needs or wants. I may or may not be among these items. There is a fact still more astounding. The absence of a mastermind, of anyone dictating or forcibly directing these countless actions which bring me into being. No trace of such a person can be found. Instead, we find the invisible hand at work. This is the mystery to which I earlier referred. It has been said that only God can make a tree. Why do we agree with this? Isn't it because we realize that we ourselves could not make one? Indeed, can we even describe a tree? We cannot, except in superficial terms. We can say, for instance, that a certain molecular configuration manifests itself as a tree. But what mind is there among men that could even record, let alone direct, the constant changes in molecules that transpire in the lifespan of a tree? Such a feat is utterly unthinkable. I, pencil, am a complex combination of miracles. A tree, zinc, copper, graphite, and so on. But to these miracles, which manifest themselves in nature, an even more extraordinary miracle has been added. The configuration of creative human energies. Millions of tiny know-hows configurating naturally and spontaneously in response to human necessity and desire, and in the absence of any human masterminding. Since only God can make a tree, I insist that only God could make me. Man can no more direct these millions of know-hows to bring me into being than he can put molecules together to create a tree. The above is what I meant when writing, if you can become aware of the miraculousness which I symbolize, you can help save the freedom mankind is so unhappily losing. For if one is aware that these know-hows will naturally, yes, automatically, arrange themselves into creative and productive patterns in response to human necessity and demand, that is, in the absence of governmental or any other coercive masterminding, then one will possess an absolutely essential ingredient for freedom, a faith in free men. Freedom is impossible without this faith. Once government has had a monopoly of a creative activity, such, for instance, as the delivery of the mails, most individuals will believe that the mails could not be efficiently delivered by men acting freely. And here is the reason. Each one acknowledges that he himself doesn't know how to do all the things incident to mail delivery. He also recognizes that no other individual could do it. These assumptions are correct. No individual possesses enough know-how to perform a nation's mail delivery any more than any individual possesses enough know-how to make a pencil. Now, in the absence of faith in free men, in the unawareness that millions of tiny know-hows would naturally and miraculously form and cooperate to satisfy this necessity, the individual cannot help but reach the erroneous conclusion that mail can be delivered only by governmental masterminding. If I, pencil, were the only item that could offer testimony on what men can accomplish when free to try, then those with little faith would have a fair case. However, there is testimony galore. It's all about us and on every hand. Mail delivery is exceedingly simple when compared, for instance, to the making of an automobile, or a calculator, or a grain combine, or a milling machine, or to tens of thousands of other things. The lesson I have to teach is this. Leave all creative energies uninhibited. Merely organize society to act in harmony with this lesson. Let society's legal apparatus remove all obstacles the best it can. Permit these creative know-hows freely to flow. Have faith that free men will respond to the invisible hand. This faith will be confirmed. I, pencil, seemingly simple though I am, offer the miracle of my creation as testimony that this is a practical faith, as practical as the sun, the rain, a cedar tree, the good earth. End of I, Pencil, by Leonard E. Reed. We hope you have enjoyed this June 1990 edition of the Freeman on Tape. For information on subscribing to the Freeman on Tape, write the Foundation for Economic Education, 30 South Broadway, Irvington on Hudson, New York, 10533. Or call area code 914-591-7230. Welcome to the Freeman on Tape, June 1990 edition. The Freeman on Tape is the audio cassette edition of The Freeman, published by the Foundation for Economic Education, 30 South Broadway, Irvington on Hudson, New York, 10533. The Freeman on Tape, June 1990 edition, contains Side 1, The Economic Wisdom of a Connecticut Yankee by Russell Shannon. Taking the Train to Metamora by William B. Irvine. The Theory of Due Reparations by Ridgway K. Foley, Jr. Perestroika's Missing Ingredient by E.C. Peisauer. The Genesis of Industrial Policy by Thomas J. DiLorenzo. Wealth, Freedom, and Philanthropy by Peter Frumkin. Book Review, Economics, Work, and Prosperity by Russell Kirk. And Perspectives. Side 2, From Gangland to Corporate America by William Granville, Jr. And a fee classic, I, Pencil, by Leonard E. Reed. The Economic Wisdom of a Connecticut Yankee by Russell Shannon. Professor Shannon teaches in the Economics Department, Clemson University. While Mark Twain's fame rests largely on his tales of youths growing up in mid-19th century America, he also wrote an incisive demonstration of the superiority of free market economics over the regulated and hierarchical society of English manorialism. Unlike Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, Twain's later work, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, is set in medieval England, where the protagonist of the story, Hank Morgan, suddenly finds himself in Camelot. It is in the chapter entitled Sixth Century Political Economy that Hank Morgan tries to persuade people of the faults in their thinking. He argues that restrictions give the impression of success because they have resulted in higher nominal wages for the protected workers. By contrast, in the area of Camelot, where Morgan has developed his enterprises without such restrictions, free market forces have resulted in lower pay measured in dollar terms. But Morgan points out that since freedom induces greater efficiency and productivity, his workers pay even lower prices for the goods they buy than workers in regulated industries must pay. finding his point hard to make, Morgan finally compares the number of hours it takes people in each situation to work in order to acquire certain necessities. At last, he is able to convince his listeners of the advantages that accrue to the unregulated workers in terms of lower costs of living and higher living standards. The extreme difficulty required to get this message across attests to the persuasive power of the principle of regulation, which still finds many adherents today. Although many details would differ, the Connecticut Yankee could just as well be set down in Stalin's Russia or Mao's China, for the criticism of medieval society could equally apply to modern totalitarian systems. Indeed, one suspects that the tenacity with which the old ideas are grasped in Twain's Camelot is matched in those countries and in Eastern Europe today. For shedding such insight on both the past and the present, Twain's work deserves more recognition than it so far seems to have achieved. Taking the Train to Metamora by William B. Irvine. Professor Irvine teaches philosophy at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio.
Not long ago, I took my family on the train to Metamora in eastern Indiana. Shortly after we pulled out of Connersville, I noticed the faint outline of the now defunct Whitewater Valley Canal running parallel to the railroad track.
There was no sign of water in this canal. There was only a ditch with slumping banks and with rather sizable trees growing from the bottom. It was only when I looked out the other side of the train that I realized that besides taking a train trip, I was traveling over a particularly interesting piece of the economic landscape. For on the other side of the train was a modern highway, being used by a variety of vehicles, including cars that had stopped to watch the steam locomotive go by. The juxtaposition of canal and rail and highway was evidence of how dramatically the economic landscape can change. The people who built the canal probably didn't imagine that a technology would arise to make it obsolete. And the people who built the rails probably did so confident in the belief that theirs was the ultimate form of transportation. By what, I wondered, will the highway be replaced? Indeed, it is entirely conceivable that my children will tell their grandchildren about the old days when people used to ride around in cars. When it comes to predicting the economic landscape decades hence, only one thing is sure. It will be radically different, almost unimaginably different from that of today. The juxtaposition of canal and rail and highway also raises a number of questions. How does a canal or railroad come into existence? How does it die? Did this particular canal and railroad die natural deaths, or were they, in effect, murdered? And if they were murdered, who was the murderer? As it turns out, the history of the Whitewater Canal is intertwined with the history of Indiana itself, and it is a history that demonstrates the extent to which politics can shape the economic landscape. When Congress admitted Indiana to the Union, it allowed a certain portion of the funds from the sale of public lands to be used for developing transportation within Indiana. There were those, including Governor James Ray, who saw canals as a dying technology and favored instead construction of railroads. In the end, though, the state set off on a binge of canal and railroad construction, authorized by the Mammoth Internal Improvement Bill of 1836, and funded both by federal money and by $10 million borrowed by the state of Indiana. The Whitewater Canal was one of the projects thus financed. The problem was that young Indiana was not ready to service the debt necessary to cover these appropriations. By 1839, the state was bankrupt. In the end, the state came up with a solution to the debt problem that was just short of repudiation. The state got out of the canal building business, and private enterprise finished the job that the state of Indiana had begun. By 1846, the Whitewater Canal connected Lawrenceburg with Cambridge City. Once built, the Whitewater Canal's days of usefulness were numbered. By 1865, the Whitewater Valley Railroad had built the line that paralleled the canal, the line that the train to Metamora takes, and the canal was rendered superfluous. It wasn't long, however, before the Whitewater Valley Railroad itself fell on hard times. By 1877, it was bankrupt. The Whitewater Valley Railroad recovered from this setback, but it ultimately suffered the fate of the canal. In this century, it ceased to be a commercially viable operation. What killed it? Again, this is a complex question. A case can be made, though, that in the same way that the railroad killed the canal by paralleling it, the modern highway, more precisely, the system of modern highways, killed the railroad. Furthermore, a case can be made, and many have made it, that the railroads died not because they are technologically obsolete. One need only look at Europe or Japan to realize as much. But because the government decided to nourish their competitor, the highway system. The Theory of Due Reparations by Ridgway K. Foley, Jr. There is a fashion in foolishness. Silly notions come and go. Some are reborn a generation or more apart. One such goofy and dangerous concept, which has gained increasing currency in this decade, is the allegation that the state of today ought to order its creative citizens to grant favors and transfer wealth to less productive persons who suffered or whose ancestors suffered a supposed earlier injury at the hands of other people. As is so often the case, removal of the mask of rage and righteousness reveals the consummate evil inherent in the very act of compelling reparations in these or like instances. First, the common law, the most just system of jurisprudence ever crafted by a fallible mankind, requires fault and causality before granting an award of damages. Fault depends upon foreseeability, knowledge, and reasonable ability to avoid harm existent at the time of the act or omission, not upon some subsequently discovered cultural or scientific truth, supposition, or superstition. Thus, one might suggest that George Washington's doctor committed malpractice in bleeding his patient during the first president's fatal bout with pneumonia in the late 18th century. Second, no acceptable theory of justice supports the claim of due reparations. Justice means to grant men their due, and no more. It requires unbridled respect for free choice. One cannot achieve justice by the commission of injustice. One does not better the world by stealing from A and transferring those stolen goods to B, less a handling charge, of course, even with the most laudable of motives. The unpleasant treatment of racial, religious, or cultural minorities certainly deserves condemnation, but one ought to differentiate between acts and omissions deserving of moral opprobrium and those subject to rectification by the law. The law should punish fraudulent and violent conduct, but no law can aptly prevent discourteous, unkind, and mean-spirited slights. The credo of due reparations is both impermissible and impossible. Any taking from a faultless individual for any purpose other than deterrence of aggression and maintenance of a system of common justice necessarily involves an impermissible transfer of wealth and liberty. We all have our pet peeves and projects for which we wish special treatment. Yet good sense and sound experience demonstrate that law and justice must be dispensed in an even-handed fashion, on a fair field with no favor. It is only when such even-handedness prevails that liberty reigns and its fruits also prevail and redound to the benefit of each of us.
Perestroika's Missing Ingredient by E.C. Pacehour. Dr. Pacehour is professor of economics at North Carolina State University at Raleigh.
Perestroika. Mikhail Gorbachev's widely discussed restructuring of the Soviet economy has done little to improve Soviet living standards. A necessary ingredient for economic coordination in a productive economy is missing in Gorbachev's perestroika. In the 1920s and 1930s, Ludwig von Mises and F. A. Hayek demonstrated that successful economic planning is impossible in a centrally directed socialist economy in which market prices are necessarily absent. Without market prices, there is no possibility of calculating costs, no meaningful profit and loss signals, and no way to determine the goods and services most highly valued by consumers. First, market prices coordinate and transmit information to various participants in the competitive entrepreneurial market process more completely and accurately than can be done through central direction. For example, when the demand for corn rises, producers tend to bid up the price of land that is suitable for growing corn and increase the amount of land used in corn production. Furthermore, producers need not know why the demand for corn has risen in order to take action that is socially beneficial. The second way that decentralized markets bring about economic coordination is through the entrepreneurial discovery process. Expected profits provide the inducements for alert entrepreneurs to become aware of profit opportunities and to search for more profitable production methods, including the development of new products. Private property is the most important missing ingredient in perestroika. There is no satisfactory alternative to a widespread use of the free market. But this is incompatible with government ownership of resources. The lesson of the socialist calculation debate suggests that the attempt to solve the Soviet economic crisis by looking within socialism rather than outside it will fail. Gorbachev's perestroika plan, which holds that prices can perform their role in productively allocating resources in a collectivist economic system, is a grand illusion.
The Genesis of Industrial Policy by Thomas J. DiLorenzo. Thomas J. DiLorenzo is the Scott L. Probosco Jr. Professor of Free Enterprise at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. This article is adapted from his book, Paved with Good Intentions, Economic Nationalism and American Industrial Policy, published by Cato Institute, 1990.
Milton Friedman recently proposed the following syllogism, which he believes characterizes much contemporary thinking about economic policy and institutions. Socialism has failed miserably wherever it has been attempted. The entire world knows this. Therefore, the world needs more socialism. This bizarre chain of reasoning is nowhere more prevalent than in contemporary proposals for a national industrial policy. Governmental economic planning by a tripartite commission of politicians, businessmen, and union leaders. So-called industrial policy was roundly criticized by nearly all mainstream economists, liberals and conservatives alike, during the early and mid-1980s. Governmental planners cannot possibly possess the knowledge required for efficient resource allocation. Only the market and price system can efficiently distill the massive information required. Why the stubborn support for such a thoroughly discredited idea? One reason, I will argue, is that industrial policy proponents are largely oblivious to both economics and history. The origins of industrial policy are in an economic system that industrial policy proponents themselves would abhor, fascism. The idea of government-business partnership is anything but new. It was, in fact, the heart of German and Italian economic policy during the 1920s and 1930s. The vehicle through which government, business, and unions would coordinate their plans was a network of government economic planning agencies, which the Italian fascists called corporations. The corporations were organized industry-wide and were intended to secure permanent collaboration between employers and workers. These corporations were Mussolini's version of the tripartite commissions that contemporary industrial policy proponents advocate. The essence of early 20th century German and Italian industrial policy and of contemporary industrial policy proposals was for government, business, and unions to attempt to collaborate to coordinate the economy in the public interest. Individual consumers, businesses, investors, and workers supposedly couldn't be relied upon to serve national rather than individual interests. Despite the public interest rhetoric, business-government collaboration in Germany and Italy constituted a mammoth conspiracy against the public. Business and government collaborated to milk the taxpayers for subsidies to big business and to establish a vast system of government-sanctioned cartels. Such business-government collaboration also created a system of monopolies through massive regulation that could forbid the creation of new factories or the development of existing plants. There was also a revolving door between government and industry, the familiar practice of government bureaucrats dishing out subsidies to industry and then retiring from government to take well-paying jobs in the industries they had previously been regulating. One doesn't need to go as far back in history as Mussolini's Italy or Nazi Germany to observe how collaboration between government, business, and unions breeds corruption and monopolization. The recent HUD and savings and loan scandals are typical examples of the inherent failures of government-industry collaboration. In each instance, businesses and government officials collaborated to benefit personally at great expense to the general taxpaying public. As the historical record of interventionist industrial policies becomes clearer, I predict the following syllogism will describe the attitudes of industrial policy proponents. Interventionist industrial policies have bred monopoly, corruption, and economic stagnation wherever they have been tried. Everyone knows this. Therefore, we need more industrial policy. Santayana's dictum that those who fail to learn the lessons of history may relive its mistakes is particularly relevant to the ongoing industrial policy debate. Wealth, Freedom, and Philanthropy by Peter Frumkin. Peter Frumkin has written on philanthropy for National Review, the Nonprofit Times, the Chronicle of Philanthropy, and other publications. Advocates of social justice maintain that the only way to achieve an equitable society is to alter the distribution of wealth substantially. Very often, they call for higher rates of marginal taxation, greater inheritance taxes, and even caps on personal wealth. What they seem to forget is that a massive accumulation of personal wealth often leads to increased charity and assistance to those who are needy. In fact, most large philanthropic institutions in the United States were founded on the wealth of one individual who was free to amass a great personal fortune. In 1988, charitable giving in the United States to all fields, including religion, human services, health, and education, totaled more than $106 billion. By any measure, this is an impressive number. It is more than the total amount of money U.S. corporations distributed to their shareholders. It exceeds total federal spending on non-defense goods and services. Over the past decade, as giving has increased, philanthropy has grown to play a critical, though often unrecognized, role in society. Private giving is a powerful vehicle for change, one which often differs radically in approach from government. In some cases, this competition can lead to the re-examination of government policy, especially in education, where government's track record in designing effective programs has been less than stellar. After philanthropist Eugene Lang adopted an entire class of inner-city schoolchildren in New York City and promised to pay for their college education if they kept their grades up and finished high school, New York State started its own program of scholarships, Liberty Partnerships, which were rather imperfectly modeled after Lang's design. Other examples of privately funded programs which government later tried to emulate include care for the elderly, shelter for the needy, and drug treatment. Without the economic freedom to garner wealth and the moral freedom to act benevolently, philanthropy cannot survive. And without a vibrant philanthropic sector, a powerful force for social innovation and change will be compromised. To those who worry about the dangers of wealth accumulation, these two facts should give cause to ponder. With its stringent economic and moral requirements, philanthropy lends crucial support to the values and principles which have made this nation prosperous and free for so many years. Book Review, Economics, Work, and Prosperity by Russell Kirk. A Becca Book publication, Box 18,000, Pensacola, Florida. 1989, 398 pages, $12.10 paperback. Reviewed by E. Calvin Beisner. It is a refreshing shock to find an excellent high school economics textbook written by one of America's finest writers, political philosophers, and historians of ideas, Dr. Russell Kirk. From the start, he alerts readers to the important difference between controlled and free economies, and how the former are doomed to failure because they try to function as if there were no economic laws. Kirk does this not by means of a theoretical discussion, but by telling the story of the pilgrims at Plymouth, who began their venture in the New World as communists, quickly found that this kind of slavery bred nothing but poverty and discontent, and then abandoned the common course and condition in favor of a free market based on private property, finding in that the secret of abundant productivity. Kirk concludes with a chapter on the economic future of the world. He castigates the prophets of doom and gloom for ignoring obvious signs that the world is getting richer, not poorer, and for advocating remedies for the world's economic ills that by their very nature cannot fail to exacerbate the problems. Here Kirk drives home the lesson that material prosperity depends upon moral convictions and moral dealings. He explains several virtues on which economic welfare depends: honesty, industry, charity, fortitude, and generosity, and shows how and why Marxism undercuts all such values. Perspective. Individual Rights by Miller Upton, Delavan, Wisconsin. The term human rights is the semantic monstrosity of the day. There are no human rights, only individual rights. Clearly, humanity has no rights. The ultimate reality of existence imposes on everyone obligations to oneself and to those with whom one shares the existence. Individual members of the human species therefore enjoy rights in relation to other individuals in both the collective and individual sense. But to suggest that one enjoys certain rights over and above these interrelational rights just by being born into the human race is to promote the kind of fuzzy semantic thinking that leads to indolence and the belief that the world owes me a living. It just may be that it is this semantic confusion that has brought about the recent tendency away from holding each individual accountable for his behavior. The Lure of Socialism by Reynold J. Thibodeau, Netherlands, Texas. Socialism has always proved attractive, and it has been with us in one form or another since the dawn of civilization. When one notes the promise of socialism, it can be readily understood how it is so easily sold to the masses. For socialism promises a utopia, a sharing of goods produced, a secure existence, equality for all, full employment and adequate food, clothing, shelter, medical treatment, and old age benefits. It should be noted that slaves were afforded the same sustenance. Humankind continues to overlook the fact that as we are provided security by the government, so also are we losing our freedom ever so gradually, and we become wards of the government. Violating the Commandments, by Hans F. Senholz, speaking at a February 6, 1990 chapel lecture, Grove City College. The laws of Judeo-Christian ethics still underlie most of our direct man-to-man relations. Acting individually, we practice, or at least seek to practice, the commandments. In our social contacts, we endeavor to live by the strictures of the commandments. But most individuals act differently as soon as they take part in the body politic. Acting in political concert, they behave in a way they would not dare to act in direct interhuman relations. They live by the motto, "Thou shalt not steal," except by majority vote. "Thou shalt not kill or coerce," except by majority decision. "Thou shalt not bear false witness," except in politics.
End of side one, The Freeman on tape. To continue, please turn the cassette over.